Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Carrie Ewart. We want to welcome you to UBC's Master of Educational Technology Program podcast for our Anti-Racism Speaker Series. I am a faculty member for the Master of Educational Technology Program, what we call MET here at UBC, and also the Equity, Diversity, Inclusion, Decolonization, and Anti-Racism Coordinator and designer of the Anti-Racism Speaker Series. We have with us today our special podcast guest, Dr. Ardavan Azadirad, who will be introduced momentarily. For our listeners, one of the ways that we begin meetings in Canada is to acknowledge the Indigenous people on whose land we benefit from. And this is part of a broader national truth and reconciliation effort in Canada and at UBC. I'm speaking on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam peoples. Our podcasting booth, MET offices, and servers are located on its territory. A more extensive statement on our commitment to Canada's 94 calls to action can be found on our MET website as the statement on commemorating Canada's National Day for Truth and Reconciliation for 2024. These calls to action invite us to commit to changes. And MET has launched a series of podcasts that will explore the role of education and technology and social justice and anti-racism as part of this call. We would like to call on today's guest, Dr. Ardavan Azadirad, to speak his territorial acknowledgement.
Great. Thank you for having me. I want to acknowledge the land I'm on, Tokoronto, which means where there are trees in water, which is the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabe, the Chippewa, and the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat people, and is now home to many diverse First Nation, Inuit, and Métis people.
Thank you so much. Now, the purpose of this speaker series is to acknowledge the commitment that every individual has to inclusivity and to addressing systemic racism. With a focus on anti-Indigenous, anti-Black, and anti-people of color racism, this series seeks to identify the responsibility educators and leaders have to facilitating and supporting anti-racist approaches and strategies within their practice to enhance and transform learning environments and learning cultures. With a specific directive being decolonization and decolonizing practices, presenters and guests will discuss racism and tools to support equity, diversity, and inclusivity, and the changing dynamic of the digital age. As a result, at MET, we are committed to a follow-up to each presentation of the speaker series with a call to action challenge. We invite listeners to make one change this month, no matter how small, and to share it with us as a next step to this podcast to eradicate racism through community building, education, and through the use of educational technologies. This call to action provides you the opportunity as listeners of this podcast to build on the anti-racist content from this session and to make steps towards change. For example, you might integrate what you've heard and thought about from this podcast with a lesson plan that will bring awareness to the issues of racism for students, colleagues, and friends. We will provide you with more details about this call for proposals at the end of this podcast. Now, today's really exciting. It is a topic that is near and dear to most of our hearts. It is the trap of binary thinking. And on today's episode, we are honored to welcome Dr. Ardavan Azadirad to the show. And Dr. Ardavan Azadirad is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Education at Wilfrid Laurier. He is also a community activist and executive director for a nonprofit organization, Youth Association for Academics, Athletics, and Character Education, or YAAACE, in the Jane and Finch community in Toronto. He was an educator with the Toronto District School Board and a former member of the Race and Identity-Based Data Collection Community Advisory Panel with the Toronto Police Service in 2021 to 2023. Dr. Azadirad is the author of many amazing books, including Decolonizing Educational Assessment Ontario Elementary Students and the EQAO from 2019, and a co-editor of Equity as Praxis in Early Childhood Education and Care 2021, Counter Narratives of Pain and Suffering as Critical Pedagogy, Disrupting Oppression in Educational Contexts, that was published in 2022, The Power of Oral Cultural in Education, Theorizing Proverbs, Idioms, and Folklores in 2023, and Enacting Anti-Racism and Activist Pedagogies in Teacher Education, Canadian Perspectives from 2023. We are in, honestly, the having greatness within our realm right now. So he is also working on two forthcoming books in 2025, Activist Leadership for Inclusive Schools, Canadian Insights, and a major international handbook, approximately with 55 chapters, entitled The International Handbook of Anti-Discriminatory Education. Dr. Azadirad is a founder of the and director of EDI-cation or Education Consulting and offering equity, diversity, inclusion training to organizations. Wow. It is such an honor to welcome you, Dr. Azadirad. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's so nice to have you on the show. And to start us off, can you tell us a little bit about your journey into the social justice field, the work that you do, and the evolution of this work, and where your passion really comes from for this work?
Yeah, thank you for that amazing introduction and all the work you're doing with this series, which is very impactful. I mean, it's always good to reflect on kind of where you are and how you got here and where you're heading. So it's always good to go through this exercise. But for me, some of the key lived experiences that really ground me in what I do as a scholar activist is, you know, being racialized. I was born in Iran. I immigrated to Toronto, Canada in October 1998 on a cold, snowy day where I saw snow for the first time. So just going through kind of settlement as an immigrant to the country, the reintegration experience, being a second language learner, those things stick with you. You know, seeing your parents kind of have to start up from scratch in a new country, experiencing some of those systemic barriers of not being able to get jobs in their field or not getting the equivalency of the educational background they have in their home country, you know, having to make new friends. So although a lot of it was negative, there is positive aspects to this, to the process as well, when you are able to achieve things and learn the language and pursue new passions. For me, you know, through basketball, you know, I joined a community where, you know, I got involved as a player, then involved playing club ball and competitively, later on transitioning to coaching and officiating, and really trying to figure out who I wanted to be and what kind of jobs I wanted to become. So through my teenage years and early adults, I lost a lot of friends to gun violence or incarceration due to being in vulnerable circumstances and making poor decisions. So you never forget the court visits, the jail visits, and it inspires you to say, how can we could change systems so people have better choices. You know, it's a balance of systemic oppression, but also personal choices, right? It's not, and this is the trap of binary thinking, right? It's not putting the fault all on the system or all on the person. It's, there is tensions and pushing and pulling across the micro and the macro, which I know we will discuss with some of your follow-up questions. So I think those experiences really impacted me. How I kind of came to be in the field of education and teacher education. I did a lot of jobs growing up, ranging from my first ever job was selling windows and doors as a telemarketer on the phone at the age of 14. I worked at Canada's Wonderland theme park, at New York Fries, selling fries for many summers. I work at a printing factory doing 12-hour shifts, stacking skids of newspapers. What I realized is I really hated routine. I hated every day being the same. And then I started transitioning to volunteer and work with Parks and Rec, with the City of Toronto, doing after school programming, working summer camps. And I started kind of enjoying that piece, while I was playing basketball. So really my passions were always education and sports. So I decided to pursue, kinesiology. Now, before that, there was a bit of a hiccup in my life where in high school, our basketball team went to an event and they stole some laptops from the school, and they came back to us. And our principal was not happy. It was a pretty well academic school, and they came hard on us. And I was offered a decision of taking a 30-day suspension or transferring to a new school without anything going on my transcript. And it was really hard decision to explain that to my parents. But the best thing was to go to a new school and not having that on my record. That happened in my grade 12 year. So it was quite a ripple effect on, you know, I had to kind of retake some courses and go to night school just to kind of bounce back from it. But it all worked out. But, you know, the adversity kind of makes you who you are. And I further then pursued kinesiology at York University and did a concurrent teacher education program there. Really, I would say one thing for listeners is you kind of go where the opportunities comes, and sometimes those opportunities are outside of your comfort zones. And to give you an example, I did my teacher education certification. Being an intermediate senior teacher, my teachables were the social sciences and health and physical education. But at the time, I got hired on the elementary panel by the Toronto District School Board because there was a push to hire male teachers. And my first job was, you know, I was offered to teach kindergarten at an elementary school. And so definitely outside of my comfort zone, but you know what? It was in a community I was familiar with at Chester Lee in Scarborough. And it really was insightful. I had a really strong early childhood educator and colleagues at the school. I got involved with leading clubs and coaching the basketball teams and getting their first championship for the girls team in 20 years. So it really became a good experience, but you have to go with an open mindset and sometimes going outside of your comfort zone in order to kind of deal with those challenges. And all of that really just continues. All of those experiences stay with me. I try to listen to others' lived experiences as a form of valuable knowledge. Emotions are also knowledge. And so in my writing, predominantly as a qualitative researcher, I try to center those experiences and what I call counter narratives to what the dominant society and discourses and narratives tell us. And that's important because we have to hear those multiple perspectives to then address the root causes of an issue.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think you come with such a plethora of experiences. I actually taught down in Albion and Finch area and experienced a lot of loss of students that were in my class due to gang activity and different circumstances. But I love what you say, that you go towards those opportunities. And instead of placing blame on situations and those pieces, that you're actually also creating opportunities for yourself. So you are truly a fascinating individual. And it helped me really to understand, and I'm sure our listeners, to see where that foundation to your work has come from and where it's led you to. So can you share your journey into academia a little bit more? And what inspired you specifically to focus on that equity, diversity, inclusion, and indigeneity in your work?
Yeah. So for me, you know, I always found it challenging. I find, you know, a lot of folks kind of are experts in like one area, like as professors or as researchers. And that's okay too. There's nothing wrong with that. But for me, you know, my PhD research looked at the impact of standardized testing. And if you're familiar with the context of Ontario, because as you know, education is a provincial or territorial matter in Canada. You know, a set of standardized tests are administered by the province in grade 3 and 6 on focusing on numeracy and literacy by the Educational Quality and Accountability Office, known as EQAO. You can kind of check out their website to learn more about it. And in grade 9, there is a math test. And in grade 10, there's a literacy test. The literacy test is a bit more high stakes. You do need to pass it to then get your Ontario Secondary School diploma and graduate from high school. And then you decide what's next for you, whether that's college, university, the trades, directly to the workforce. So I really focused on the grade 3 experience because quite a few researchers had done research on the grade 9 and the 10 standardized test. But I really wanted to capture the youth or even, you know, the young perspective on how does that going through this test impact them? What is their experiences like, particularly racialized students. So grade three, you're about 9 years old, right? As an extension, I also wanted to hear the perspective of their parents, which strategically I chose folks who were educators or administrators, vice principals or principals in schools. So really focusing on that experience, and that was my starting point of learning the language and the currency to do research. I think a lot of folks can talk about their experiences, but going through graduate school kind of gives you the theoretical framework, the terminology. So you are now able to combine just describing it and connecting it with how academics and researchers write. And the advocacy piece was the third piece that came in, right? What are we doing research for? I don't want to do a project just for the sake of saying I published something. The purpose of doing the research, and I often use the term, scholar activist, and that's what I focused on in, some of the last two co-edited books I've done with colleagues, is, the activism piece or the so what of your research is really, really important. So with standardized testing, I really wanted to show that this is not the greatest system. It doesn't mean I'm anti-large data collection, but is this the best way, given the amount of millions of dollars poured into it, to really support schools and students? Because the justification was for creating greater accountability, right? But I think over time, the test has kind of become more important than the needs of the students. And so some of the findings were the test is Eurocentric. It's a snapshot in learning. Students do it in May, June. They get the results in October. We know that, timely descriptive feedback is very important. A lot happens during that time. When they get the results, it's either you're a grade 1, 2, 3, or 4. You're expected to be at the grade 3 or higher, which is the provincial standard. There's not much about what you got wrong and how you can improve. So it doesn't align with best practices in education as we know it. And this is why I kind of proposed alternative ways of how we can work more with schools at the local level to capture that. Because teachers do that anyway. In September, you do diagnostics to see where students at. You then work with your students from September to June to improve them. So we are still collecting that data, but it's really hard when it comes externally and it's a snapshot. So that kind of was my first plunge into the research world on that scale. And since then, really, some of the experiences I talked about, I write about those things. I don't think I'm an expert in any one area, but if I had to use an umbrella term, everything I do is driven by trying to change systems to be better, which falls under the term of, advancing equitable outcomes and social justice. And I know those terms can be quite divisive, but really, this is where we kind of talk about the trap of binary thinking. It's about making communities better, and that's for everybody within that ecosystem. But we do have to focus on the folks who are kind of experiencing more challenges or more vulnerable, because if we can take care of those folks, it has a ripple effect of overall crime being reduced, everybody in the school doing better, better relationships. So the effects benefit everybody within the ecosystem. And I think that part kind of gets missed when a lot of times we are debating about, are you this or are you that? And then, since then, I've just tried to insert that. I try to mentor other students into recognizing and how to navigate the academic world and the community world. And this is why I kind of have one foot in the front lines with the community work I do through YACE, Youth Association for Academics, Athletics, and Character Education, because they do a lot of programming around education, around athletics, around violence prevention and intervention. And it's issues that really impacted me growing up. And I know if we're able to create access to opportunities for people, they're going to do well as well. So I kind of combine the academic piece and the activism and the community work. And for me, that really feeds my soul and aligns with my values.
And I think that's a perfect example of showing that theoretical underpinnings into practice and how the appropriateness to that and why it's needed. And really, at the end of the day, it's about student success. And so what we're doing to create that. So there's been a lot of criticisms and tensions in the EDI space, the equity, diversity, inclusion space, from multiple vantage points and personal stances. What exactly is the trap of binary thinking that you want to deconstruct in your work?
So binary thinking is kind of presenting that there's only two stances, right? You think of binary, it's A or B. So for example, LGBTQ two-spirit plus identities, right? Some people will say, well, are you pro or are you con? Should we have these books or should we not have them? Another example would be, hey, when universities are hiring, should they consider the identity of the people or not? Is it purely merit-based or is it identity-based and is it a handout, right? So I think those are good starting points, but the meaningful conversations involve a little bit of both perspectives. You know, the answer is it depends. Who are we talking about? What is the context? What does the process look like? How can it be supplemented, right? So it doesn't have to be, I'm all in for the books or I'm not. It's, hey, what grades, for example, are the most appropriate? How will it be introduced? How will the teachers be trained if they're being introduced, right? With the identity-based data collection, you know, we got a election going on in the States, and, you know, with some defeats in affirmative action, there's been kind of some step backs around this EDI movement. And one side presents it as a handout, right? Like, hey, are they an EDI hire or was it merit-based? Well, in reality, hiring practices should be a combination of both. It should, of course, be merit-based. You should be experienced and have the qualifications. But if there's two people or three people who are very, very equal in all of those things and experience and qualification, whose identity will have a bigger impact based on the community that they're supposed to serve? So, for example, at Yace, they serve the Jane and Finch community. Having Black educators who look like the students and who have community connections and understands the daily reality of the students does make sense. Because those teachers who now teach in the school in the same ecosystem all year round, they're able to connect with those students and families and create that continuity of care that they need. That's lacking in their larger experiences when we know there's underrepresentation with the type of educators in the school system, right? Now, that is unique to that community's needs. But if we're talking about another community, maybe the needs are different. So that's why context is so important. So binary thinking is about A or B. In our online digital world, there's a lot of digital wanksters who kind of, you know, hate on you on virtual platforms without really being in community and doing the frontline work. So I would, you know, I encourage people, for people who disagree with you, who have no relevance, don't even give them your time and energy, because that's exactly what they want, right? So being in this space, you do get a lot of resistance, but you have to go back to your why. Why are you doing this work? What is the purpose and what are you trying to achieve? And who do you want to come along with that ride? And if you receive that resistance and if you spend too much time on it, it deviates you from that goal. So you have to remind yourself, you know, what is the impact? And of course, it's never easy to challenge systems, but I always present this counter argument. If you love someone, whether it's your children, the people you coach, your family, you are going to be honest with them and you are going to give them sometimes tough criticism, which are tough conversations like, hey, you're not achieving to your full potential. But it seems like as a society, we have a really hard time doing that with our institutions. When we criticize our institutions, people kind of get offensive and say, whoa, 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 if you're not happy, why did you come to Canada? Well, instead, let's look at it this way. I love Canada so much that I want it to be its best version. And that requires sometimes having some introspective, critical conversations about how can we do this better together? And what is the role of everybody?
I think that that was a really great analogy. And really what comes to that is the idea of representation, responsiveness, and just looking at things and having these critical conversations with an open mind and an open heart. So thank you very much for sharing that. Now, to kind of spin off that, what strategies have you found to be effective in engaging people who may be resistant or indifferent to anti-racism and EDI efforts?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things. I think what we say and how we present it is very important. And based on what is the context, what is the age group, right? These are conversations we should be having with children, all the way to adults, all the way in people who are becoming teachers and teacher ed programs or across programs where other people are being trained, being in schools, social workers, child and youth workers, early childhood educators. I, in a classroom setting, start off by really deconstructing, like, what is a safe space versus a brave space, right? A safe space, for example, I say, I cannot guarantee a safe space. So I discourage people to stand in front of a class and say, this is a safe space. I want you to share and say what you want, because I cannot control how others perceive that. But so as a counter to that, we use the term brave space, which is actually, how do we consider other perspectives that are different than ours, that are rooted in a different lived experiences than ours? Because what we experience becomes our baseline, right? I use the term vantage point. And to break that down, if you live in an apartment, right? It's a very different view if you come straight out of the lobby and look, or if I say, go to the roof of the apartment and now look, your vantage point is going to be different. And it's the same thing when it comes to social issues. If you played sports, maybe you get my sports analogy. But there's people who hate sports because they had a really negative experiences in sports. So they're not going to have that connection, right? So you want to be using a range of examples and entry points so people can start seeing themselves in the story or the social issue you're talking about. So a brave space asks people to really consider different perspectives and take calculated risks. Come out of your comfort zone. Think about it outside of your own body. And that's a process that takes time. It's not going to happen like this overnight. And a lot of that has to do with trust, because if you trust me and I have that relationship with you, then you're going to listen more. And when that's not there, you're likely just going to dismiss it, right? So that's a starting point. I'm going to throw in a couple of other strategies because I don't want the conversation to be just theoretical. I really have a core concept that I introduce to everybody, whether it's my class or in the circles where we're talking about EDI. It's called the first hour needs. And it's this concept that if in the first hour of the day, you identify what are the unmet need of the person you're dealing with, you're not going to be spending the next 23 hours kind of being reactive and guessing and hoping it's a good day. And whether you're a child or an adult, we all have the same needs around, nutrition, safety, emotional acknowledgement. All of those pieces are the same. It's just to a different degree in people, right? So you have to build relationship to know those needs. And once you know those needs through communicating with a student, their families, understanding the demographics and the systemic barriers in the community that you teach, you're able to better connect the dots, and you're able to sometimes show caring love and sometimes show tough love, because your different students and different people need different types of love, and you have to figure that out. And those are really, really important. The last example I'll share around strategies is actually two more strategies. One is calling in versus calling out, right? That terminology has kind of gained a lot of momentum, and there's quite a body of literature on it. So calling in is when we want to kind of tell someone, hey, let's look at this from another lens. Is that what you really meant? Like, we don't want you to leave the table, because if you leave us having a discussion, there's no way we can move forward with a shared understanding, right? And think about it. Did you always have the same stance on the same issue? It's okay to change your stance and perspective, because you grow and evolve. If you're staying stagnant, then you're not really evolving, right? And so calling is when we can have those follow-ups, those prompts to have those dialogue, which is what we need. Calling out happens when there is harm involved. Like, if someone is abusing a child, you're not going to be like, hey, I think you should consider stopping, right? It's when you have to be more direct, you need to more step in, you have to stop the harm immediately, And then there is time for maybe restorative justice and reflection and consequences, right? So calling in versus calling out, those are really good way. The last analogy, and I like analogies a lot, as you'll see, is helping people break away from the baby elephant syndrome. And if you never heard of that, this is how it works. When they're training elephants, they tie a rope or a chain to the ankles of the baby elephant. And because the elephant is not strong enough, it tries and it tries and it tries. And eventually in their psyche, they get to the conclusion that they are not strong enough. And when they get to that, for pretty much the rest of their lives, they accept that position of subordination. And they don't try. So when they bring the elephants at the zoo, you'll notice the chain marks on their ankles. And it's a reminder of the control and what they think of themselves. But as a large elephant, of course, they can break free. But the psychological shackles are holding them down. And so we have a lot of that ourselves, whether it's internal oppression. Maybe we don't think we're beautiful enough. Maybe we don't think we're good at math. Maybe we don't think we're good at writing. Maybe we don't think we're good at social speaking in front of crowds. And as a result of accepting that false truth about our ability, we deviate away from any opportunity that involves that. But maybe it wasn't you. Maybe you had a bad teacher. Maybe you had a bad day. So we have to go back and get ourselves and our students to question these truths about ourselves. And is it really a truth or is it an opinion? And how can we retry? And so it's the same thing, I think, when it comes to EDI. You know, if you really had a negative experience, don't dismiss all EDI efforts and vice versa. It doesn't mean as an EDI scholar activist, I support every EDI effort because maybe I don't agree with the strategy or the approach. This is where we need the dialogue. And this is where we have to overcome the trap of binary thinking, because if we spend all our time saying I'm right and you're wrong and vice versa, we never get to talk about the richness of, wait, what's the context here? How can we combine our perspectives? And so that piece is so crucial. And I think politically, even in the context of Canada with the Liberals and Conservatives and in the States with the election coming up with Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, we're at a standstill where it's a lot of hating, it's a lot of I'm right and you're wrong, and not enough dialogue. And that really essentially is the work of EDI, is to facilitate those dialogue in a meaningful way that leads to change that benefits everybody in the ecosystem, whether that's the school, but I always talk about school community because it's about the issues that impact the school relative to the community where the school is located.
I couldn't agree more. And you said so many important things there. And I think as educators, we have a really important role to look at things from a low floor, high ceilings, wide walls and open windows perspective, in taking people where they are and being able to work with them and have those critical conversations. But even more importantly, to be cognizant of our own inherent biases and how we're approaching those conversations. I think you gave a lot of really important analogies, and I love the analogies. And even they have seen baby elephants that have, when they're older, the string around their ankle. And that string, they just have that mental block almost, because they think it's the shackles from before. So a lot of this work that you speak to have come from the research that you've done and the incredible books that you've published. And you've both written and edited so many books across so many different topics. What made you select these topics, and what are some of the books about? And just to continue on, this is kind of a multi-part question. Have you got any pushback or resistance to these topics and to these publications, and how did you handle or cope with it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would start by saying, if you're doing equity work, there should be resistance and you should expect it, right? Like, it shouldn't be like you're going against the norm. And when you go against something, you're presenting a counter narrative. You're trying to center something that maybe is there as an add-on or a superficial way and say, hey, I want this to be at the core of our vantage point. And people who are there, you know, I say the three P's always complicate things. You know, people in power, people in privilege, and then the profit-oriented nature of our institutions, right? Power, privilege, and profit. They create the push and the pull and the tension. And so there's going to be resistance. So what I say, and then I'm going to talk about some of the topics, is you got to find what fills up your cup. Because if your cup is not full, you can't pour into others, right? So things like having a mentor, whether that's virtual across the country in another country or not, right? Whether it's in person, right? Knowing what are your coping mechanisms that work for you. Whether for me, it's exercising, going to the gym, going for walks, making time with friends and family. There's no one way that works for me. You got to work. What is the best system that works for you? Right. And then last piece, I think, is just have a community, right? Whether it's an online virtual community at your school based on a passion or an interest, where you can talk to others about what you're going through and get some advice, right? There's no, a lot of these things are teachable moments, and there's no always a formula of how to handle them. But knowing your values and what you're willing to stand up for always makes it easier to navigate. So for me, yes, there's always been pushback. I mean, I think anybody who writes about EDI topics, for me, you know, EQAO, people say, well, if we don't have EQAO and standardized testing, how will we know schools are doing what they're supposed to? It's going to be a free-for-all, and there'll be chaos, and there'll be no accountability. Okay, well, I said, you've interpreted, or you made the assumption that just because I'm saying we don't need EQAO, we don't need large data sets. That's incorrect. We should collect large data sets, but is there a way we do it in partnership with schools, with community organizations, that is authentic, that really addresses the root causes? Because if we look at the standardized testing system was introduced in Ontario in 1998, the disparities have actually increased. They haven't actually decreased. So is this test serving its purpose? And is it supporting the schools that continue to show underachievement? So for me, I've really, really worked hard to say it's not an achievement gap, it's an opportunity gap. If we ensure those schools are supported, and sometimes it's the things outside of the classroom. Can the kids afford glasses? Can they see a doctor? Can the families be connected with translators or people who speak their language? Is there enough identity celebration of the students and the community? And is the school working with the larger agencies in the larger community surrounding the school, right? So those conversations are important to have, to present. Once again, it's not A or B, but how are we making change? So for me, I'm always driven by what moves me. And that kind of depends on what is going on in the world, what is going on in my life. So I started looking at standardized testing. Then I was teaching in an East early childhood education program at TMU. And I had wonderful colleagues, Rachel Berman and Zora Bawi, who were also there. And so we were both all fans of the work of Paulo Freire and his problem posing model of education and praxis being equity and action and reflection, right? And so that led us to a co-edited volume called Equity as Praxis, really applying those concepts in the focus of ECE field. And later on, you know, I'm always kind of still in the space of supporting folks who are dealing with a lot of trauma, whether that's violence, incarceration, losing loved ones, you know, being in poverty, single parent households. So we started looking at, you know, how do we center these counter narratives of pain and suffering as a form of pedagogy? And it really connected with this idea of safe space, brave space, trauma-informed care, culturally responsive practices, things we were trying to implement at YACE and lead in our programming, but also talk about in our classes. And I collaborated with Dr. Andrew Campbell, aka Dr. ABC, and Dr. Steve Sider at Laurie on that project. I was in teacher education, you know, doing a lot of this work, and always fascinated by how stories connect with people. And there are these universal stories across time, space, and countries. Like, for example, the boy who cried wolf. There's an example of that in every culture, right? And so it led me to work with a former, you know, colleague of mine at U of T, who was the chair of the social justice education, Dr. Jokey Wayne. And we did a whole series called The Power of Oral Culture. We wanted to bring proverbs, idiom, and stories into the classrooms. And then the last one, really, you know, I said, what does it mean to be a scholar activist? Particularly focusing on teacher education, because as of 2020, I've been at Laurier, and teacher education, I think, is where my home and my really the perfect space for me. And so we really want to center Canadian perspectives. And once again, to some of the questions you asked, what are some of the challenges of bringing in this anti-racist activist pedagogies? Because some people will say, well, that has nothing to do with teaching and the curriculum. Why are we teaching students that? And I would argue that really education is not just what's on the pages of the curriculum documents, but there's a curriculum of life. And if you're not engaged or you don't feel valued and seen, you're not going to show up and want to learn. And so the identity piece and belonging and being seen and heard is so important. We can't just dismiss that. It's part of a holistic lens of looking at education that aligns with indigenous ways and perspectives and epistemologies, as well as many African and non-Eurocentric ways and theoretical frameworks that's important to consider rather than dismiss.
That is fantastic. And with your permission, we will share all of these books on our site so that everybody can have access to those.
Yes, please do. Yeah, the more the purpose of these things are to really generate conversation. I hope people don't read the work as I'm right and you're wrong. It's really about what do you get out of it and how can you apply it? And I think that that's the best way to really use and read any resource.
Absolutely. And taking it back and doing something with it, really, which is part of our call to action with this series. So just moving forward, I'd love to know, how do you integrate the decoloniality and the Indigenous perspectives and anti-racism into your teaching and your research? And you've spoken part and parcel to these pieces, but also to your community work and your nonprofit, YAACE, I believe you called it, the acronym YAACE. Can you share some specific examples around this, please?
Yeah, I think just two examples. One, I think in my classes and really in everything I do, I try to push the boundary. I think we're in a technological space where we don't want you to be just knowledge consumers, right? That was something of the past. We want folks to be knowledge producers. So you kind of engage with something and then you critically apply and question things and say, hey, how can I produce something, right? So if you think of people who are on Instagram, which is a major platform, you're producing, you're telling a story. For folks who are listening to podcasts such as these, you're listening to stories and connecting with them. And with the call to action, you're producing something. So in my classes, I've really shifted from large papers, which there's nothing wrong with, but just to mix it up, students are producing public service announcement videos, where it requires them to take the readings and the constructive criticism they have and creating a video which brings awareness or serves as a form of resource with statistics and resources for extensional learning. I've also done this in a more visual format where instead of video, students produce infographics, and then their job is to go out there and share the resource in their communities, in the schools they're at. And the feedback I got is, you know, they find such process much more engaging and insightful rather than summarizing an article or writing a paper. And so the group dynamic piece is also important because folks have to work with others who might have different perspectives. And that's where the dialogue happens. That's where the disagreement happens, which is okay. But what's important is folks having that constructive stance of why they feel that way, right? So I always say, if you're triggered by a comment, what's more important is you take a moment to reflect what caused that reaction, what is it rooted in, what value and perspectives, and can you think differently and shift and, you know, consider that different vantage point. I think in a community sector, you know, the nonprofit sector work that we're doing at YAACE, what we try to do is we really try to be data driven and measure the impact of programming and the innovative solution. So we're really big on applying a public health approach to violence prevention and intervention, which is really saying, what are the social determinants of health, and particularly the social determinants of violence? Is it, you know, poverty, single parent households, peer exposure, if you were previously incarcerated? All of these things matter. And you have to be able to present a quantitative case for what you're suggesting. It's easy to present impact through stories, which is a great strategy, but sometimes people will say, well, that's your experience. That's not everyone's experience, right? And so there becomes a way to dismiss what you're trying to do, whether it's trying to change policy or ask for funding. But when you can come with the numbers, whether that's cost and savings, for example, one homicide in Canada costs taxpayers $6 million in direct and indirect costs. When you calculate people who show up to the scene, court costs, when people have to go to the hospital, when you miss work, right? So prevention is better than intervention. So if someone is asking for $1 million for a program that can prevent 100 people from committing homicides or being reincarcerated in the long term, that leads to savings. So you have to be able to speak that language. And that's important, really, to be able to navigate spaces and audiences. But in my work, really, through the readings and through the specific trauma-informed and culturally responsive pedagogies that we want to promote is how I center kind of decoloniality. It's really pushing against the norm and the norm being constructed by kind of colonial discourse and in many cases, white supremacy. And that's a word that triggers people. But then you have to deconstruct it, because I would say not everybody uses that term. You don't need to be white to perpetuate white supremacy. It's not skin color we're talking about. It's the values and the vantage points that become the lens that we judge the world and then doesn't create space for the counter narrative. So how can we poke holes in those assumptions and epistemologies?
And I think it goes back to your three P's that you introduced, the whole idea of power, privilege, and profit, and really why are people doing what they're doing, and looking at it from that decolonized, looking at the oppression, the anti-racism aspect of it, I think is really, really important work. And that actually feeds into my next question for you. You're doing so many incredible things. I'd love to know a little bit about the Equity, Diversity, Inclusion, Indigenization, or EDDI and I coalition that you chair at Laurier, and something that I am very excited to be part of in the upcoming fall as I join Laurier. But what are your directives and current initiatives within this particular coalition? And what are the key goals and objectives and how are you working to achieve those?
Yeah, thank you. So the coalition, you know, I joined Laurier in January 2020 and, you know, I started a coalition based on the community work I'm doing, where I see it's always more impactful when you can bring people together, sometimes across a range of spaces and identities, to organically have these conversations. So it was meant to be an organic space where people gather and we say, what do we want to improve and how do we do it? And how can we all contribute? So at the early onset, you know, it was a very small group of 5 to 6 people. And over time, based on the work we did and the recruitment we did, and the resources we were able to secure, we were able to grow. We had to co-construct everything because it was organic. So things like the logo were constructed by graduate students. We had to define what do we want to be called. We went through some, you know, reiterations, you know, what comes first. You know, sometimes we do get caught up in the semantics of, you know, the words. And I think that's something for folks to be cognizant of. The impact is always the most important, right? The titles and how we do it. The question becomes, what is the impact and how are you measuring it? And it doesn't mean the process has to be perfect. So for us, we start as an EDI coalition. Then we added indigenization, and there was conversations that indigenization go first and whatnot. And those are all great conversation. But once again, we shifted to really focus on impact. But we did come up with our kind of mission statement, which is disrupt, question, advocate, and create change through dialogue, collaboration, partnership, events, and resources to advance the work of equity, diversity, inclusion, and indigenization as a collective coalition within the Faculty of Education, where we're housed, but also in the larger community. You know, every September, we really try to recruit students. There's a couple of things we've done over time. One of our key events is we do a teacher diversity event, recognizing the lack of teacher diversity across Canada and the range of communities. So we work with the Waterloo school boards to bring, we started in our first year with 50 students from equity deserving groups, and we allow the school boards who know their students best to identify those students and bring them for a day on campus. They get a tour of the campus. They get to hear perspectives of teacher candidates, faculty and staff, particularly from Indigenous and minoritized and racialized perspective, learn about the resources available and what life in post-secondary school looks like, and do some team building, and then they leave. And so we're continuing to build on that. We went from 50 to 100 students, adding a Indigenous opening ceremony and closing. And we want to continue to build on that by doing something that is more continuous. We know one-off events have limitations. So we are also extending this to our Brantford campus this year in 2025 and see how we can maybe gather the students before and after to create some more capacity building in them. All right, we have an Instagram account that is run by students. You know, we do encourage you to follow us. It's at @LaurierEDU_EDII. We also have a link tree where we post resources. So I highly recommend folks checking that out. The one thing, last thing, which I think will be beneficial to listeners is we had a lot of teacher candidates tell us, like, we're really passionate about social justice, but we feel uncomfortable talking about race or sexuality or sexual orientation. Like, how do we do it? They wanted to know more about the how. And so what we did is, you know, as a collective, we curated a set of resources. We called it, an equity, diversity, inclusion, indigenization resource bank. So we cultivated and grouped them by age groups and provided little brief summaries. And that's an open access resource that's available and folks can check out to help them come up with activities to teach children in age appropriate and culture reflective ways. And it covers quite a range of topics. And so those are some of the things. We've also had what we call last year, our most recent initiative, Brave Conversation Series, reflecting kind of what we just deconstructed as brave conversations and the importance of dialogue. So we had a series of monthly speakers, some of them students in the program, come with a wealth of experiences and professional work, as well as faculty internal and external. And this year, we hope to kind of build on that to create a Brave Conversations podcast, which will be tapping into your experience.
Absolutely. That is all fantastic stuff. And with your permission, I've started a culturally responsive resource, OER, with UBC. So maybe sharing some of those through that OER as well, and just kind of that cross-section, because we're always looking for ways to start those conversations. And it's not necessarily that educators don't want to have them. They just don't know how to get started and how to have those and create those brave spaces, really. So with that in mind, how is your coalition working to influence curriculum changes, really, to better reflect equity, diversity, inclusion, and Indigeneity at Wilfrid Laurier?
So really, I mean, sometimes we do events, sometimes it's resources, and sometimes it's this bigger pieces, right? So when it comes to curriculum or moving larger policy pieces, some of the things we've done is we updated our lesson plan that all teacher candidates use in the program for the 2 years, and we added a EDI&I component. We then embedded the resource bank within that lesson plan for folks to be able to access it, because it was a concern across the program. And so it was getting people to think beyond accommodations and modifications, which is the language and terminology you learn being in a teacher education program. So equity is not just a give someone extra time, which is what a lot of students were just referring to, right? And so it was getting them to think and look at the nuances, the identity piece, the belonging, the relationship building that is so important, right? Understand the community. So that was one of our major kind of bigger pieces we moved. Right now, we're in the process of looking at admissions. And it's a bit of a tricky area because everyone is trying to figure it out, from random lotteries being introduced by school boards, medical schools. Once again, it doesn't mean I personally don't agree with a lottery approach. I think there can be a more balanced way, but that's something we're trying to figure out. We've done a bit of a pilot looking at identity of people who apply to who get in, and we are trying to figure out, working with admissions and legal, how can we build and create that balance between merit, considering different vulnerable circumstances, and also identity and the lived experiences, so we have a great cross representation of folks in our program. And so we're building on that piece. The teacher diversity event, once again, really is getting folks in and our school partners to think about how can we work together, post-secondaries and K-12 schools, to increase teacher diversity. Because whether the community you teach in is diverse or not, it's an essential skill set given the world we're in and how we're all interconnected. And so those are some of the bigger pieces we're trying to do.
That is all fantastic in giving back. And just the final question in this about the coalition is, looking at the work that you're doing, can it serve as a model for other institutions looking to enhance their EDI&I and anti-racism efforts? And what would you say to that?
It is a very unique model. Myself and co-chair of the coalition, Dr. Jennifer Straub, recently just published a chapter on this, talking about why the coalition approach is more impactful than a committee approach. And to just delve into that, when you become a committee, you are governed by very specific rules in a higher ed setting, right? Around how you have to govern, how you have to communicate. So although suggestion had been made for us to be formalized, we choose with intentionality to be not formalized, because it gives us a bit of a freedom to operate outside of sometimes those restrictive rules, but it does also have challenges, because then maybe we do not have a set of resources upfront allocated as a committee. So we go out and secure the resources through applying for grants, applying for resources, asking for in-kind donations. And so you kind of weigh the positives and the negatives, but what has been so great about this coalition approach, that it's like, it's okay if you can't come to two meetings or three meetings because you got other priorities in life happening. We don't hold that against you. Please come when you can, but when you do show up, we know you're motivated and we know you want to be there, and you're not there just to say you were just on another club and you want that on your resume or at graduation. So really the why drives people. And I think the coalition approach allows you to invite people. We've invited people from outside the university, from outside of our department, for people who are passionate to really be there. And it has really driven the process and led us to these projects that just come up organically, right? And some things we've continued to kind of build and develop and refine based on the new perspectives that arrive and critique it from a new lens, which is what we need. It allows this coalition thing allows us to look at really who's at the table. Does it reflect the community we serve? And as a good friend of mine, Charlene Grant, who's the executive director of Parents of Black Children, always told me from a law background, is we always have to ask this two question. The first one is, if there is a policy, when was it last written? Was it ever reformed? And at the time of its creation or reform, who was at the table, and did it reflect the community that it serves? And really, those questions have always stuck with me when I'm in meetings and we're talking about change. You know, I always say, whose perspectives are missing? And is this policy going to serve the needs of all the people in the community? And if not, how can we ensure it's adapted or reformed to really make that happen?
I think the coalition just provides agency. It provides that flexibility to do some incredible things. And those last two questions, I know at the Met, we teach a course, ETEC 531, and it's looking at curriculum jamming and what is missing, what are those missing voices and those missing perspectives from curriculum. So a lot of alignments there. Now, you spoke about challenges and you spoke about motivation, and I want to know, how do you stay motivated and sustain the momentum in your work, especially when there are so many challenges and setbacks in that area?
That's a great question. I think for me, it's find joy in the work you do and the people you hang out with. So if you notice, Pretty, a lot of my work, I would say 80%, is with others. And it's with people I don't just call colleagues. It's people I call friends, I call family. I hang out with them. And it's not always academic talk, because it sounds cliche, but the trust and the relationship building is so important. We're not just talking about it in books. You got to live it. You got to believe in it if you're writing about it and advocating for it. And so for me, why I went back to the community spaces, there was a time where I felt like I was being suffocated and it was just too theoretical. And I needed to kind of go back, you know, to my beginnings of coaching, being in front of the students. And being at Yace allows me to balance it, and it brings me that joy, and it feeds into then the academic piece and the connecting with the community of colleagues and the scholar activists I write about. So that piece is really important. Be open to change. I think it's important, right? I know sometimes people are like hard advocates, but also recognize there's a time and a space. Nobody wants to be around a 24/7 advocate, always making small things into big things. There's a time to turn it on, and there's a time to turn it off, and there's a time to take a break. And that's going to be different for everybody. There's no one person or one right way, but know what works for you, right? And so I think that has always worked for me, right? In my writing, I turn it on, in my community work. But then there's also times I just want to sit back and, you know, enjoy a hip hop song that maybe the message is not so great. I still embrace the art and the artistry that goes into that, reflecting my passion for music or going to a concert, right? I could still appreciate a Dave Chappelle comedy set, which sometimes might have messages that people might not like, but is he facilitating dialogue by what he's saying and how he's delivering it, right? So I think there is a, and we didn't talk too much about this, but there's a danger in cancel culture that it shuts down conversation, just like there is a danger in extremist conservative views that tries to cancel more liberal views, right? And so both extreme ends are using the same logic and theoretical framework to actually not allow the other person to speak, which without dialogue, we can't move the needle. And so we have to meet in the middle. Once again, how do we make that happen? And so we have to take risks, and we have to come out of our own perspectives and be able to have some of those tough conversations, but then go back to the drawing board and say, what does that mean for me and the community I'm in?
And I think creating those brave spaces, as you mentioned, to take those risks and to have those that critical dialogue is really important. And just as we finish up, I have two more questions and appreciate your time. What would you say is your vision for the future of equity, diversity, and inclusion in indigenization in higher education and community? And what changes do you hope to see happen in the next 5 years, the next 10 years?
It's hard to predict the future, but I think we really have to adapt with technology. I think artificial intelligence is a very interesting field. It's creating solutions. It's helping create accessibility. Of course, it can also have its challenges or pitfalls, but I think it has more benefits if used and applied the right way. So I would love to see how AI can be used to amplify counter narratives, to connect people across the world or in communities, connect schools with community agencies and neighborhoods to create and support and work together to provide continuity of care to the families, to center indigenous epistemologies and ways of being that are holistic, right? So I think that's a major one. The other one is really how do we continue to mitigate the opportunity gap? Once again, I think if people and families are given the right opportunities, they will excel. A lot of this is around access and access to particularly opportunities. And that requires us through EDI and AI thinking innovatively, thinking outside the box. If solutions that have been presented have been applied for the last 10 years and it haven't had the impact, why are we still doing it? How can we pivot? How can we say, how can we, maybe we need to throw everything out, start from scratch, or what's working and what's not working and how can we make tweaks, right? So I think, the higher education, for example, works well with schools. I think we need to focus more with also working with community agencies who surround the school and provide a lot of evening and weekend, because what happens in our students' lives on evenings and weekends trickle into schools and vice versa. So those are just some of the areas that I think I would like to see, and through the work I'm doing, continue to advocate for some merge and synergy within the EDI and I space.
And to borrow from business sectors, looking at that SWOT analysis and those strengths
Yes.
and weaknesses. And as you know, a lot of my work and research recently has been in artificial intelligence, and we've been talking about the way to use it as a way to mitigate challenges and as a means to how are we pushing past those policies and those protocols and data surveillance and those pieces to really use it for good and to push things forward. So as we finish up, last question, what advice would you give to emerging teachers or people new in the community spaces as frontline workers? And then to add on to that, is there anything additional that you would like to add during this time in this last in these last few minutes?
Yeah, I mean, I think just beyond the earlier suggestions of finding a mentor and you know, figure out your coping mechanisms, I think I would say what's really important is being consistent. I think a lot of times we're so fixated on perfection, but being consistent will always overcome imperfection, right? So if you constantly show up for a kid who's giving you a hard time, you're going to build their trust and you'll have the breakthrough. If you're struggling to write a PhD thesis, but if you keep chipping and keep writing and break it down and focus on smaller chapters, eventually you have enough and it becomes a great chapter. So once again, be consistent, and the consistency will overcome imperfection, and that's important. The last one is the road will never be perfect, and you shouldn't expect it to be perfect. So embrace the teachable moments, right? The more tools you have in your toolbox, the more you're able to handle teachable moments. And that's a combination of professional experiences and lived experiences, knowing your own triggers, managing your emotions. It's just like muscle memory and playing a sport. The more you do it, the better you get at it. There's always a science and there's an art to it. And in life, you're trying to balance the two along with all the priorities in your life. And so it's a bit of a give and take. It's a bit of learn, relearn, and unlearn. And I'll leave with one of the sayings I live my life by is, the key to life is never make the same mistake twice. So every time you have a teachable moment, ask yourself, what did I control? What was out of my control? And then put your energy into things you had control over, because that can perhaps change the impact or the outcome of the situation, and take that knowledge to a situation that is similar next time you find yourself, and you'll be able to better navigate it.
Thank you so much. That was amazing. And it's interesting that every single, and when I say every single, I mean everybody that we've had on this anti-racism speaker series have said that the key is to show up and be there and be present and be open to possibilities and changes. So thank you so much to our amazing guest, Dr. Azarad, for your thoughtful and impactful and enlightening responses. I think you helped us to unpack the anti-racism and that trap of binary thinking in a very clear and dynamic way. And you shared so many thoughtful and necessary points, which I think can influence so many of our listeners. Now, as mentioned prior to the presentation, our intention of the speaker series is to eradicate racism through these small and large steps towards change. And what we've heard today are many strategies and many steps to be able to do that. And so as such, we created this call to action to move those teachings and learnings from today's podcast section and session forward. We challenge every listener of today's podcast to participate in one act of change. This could be having a conversation with a neighbor or a colleague about something that resonated with you from today's podcast. It could be to create an interactive lesson or workshop or session on anti-Black racism, anti-Indigeneity, anti-people of color, or just looking at that trap of binary talk and binary change and looking to increase include these voices of all peoples in the digital community to share with students or colleagues or peers or staff. You might create a subset presentation to this podcast to react to the discussion on today's session, or communities to draw awareness to these issues. So that we ask that you continue the conversation by sharing what you would do to implement the content of today's session into your personal and or professional life. You can use the hashtag MET and hashtag UBC anti-racism. So when it comes to the availability of impactful and culturally sensitive lesson plans that address anti-racism, there are very limited sources and resources that are available. So we urge you on a grander gesture for any interested listeners of today's session to submit a lesson plan that aligns the content from our interview with Dr. Ardavan as Adirat, to submit a lesson plan that aligns with the content from this session with your curriculum in an attempt to create good quality racism resources to put in the hands of educators. And this lesson plan call to action can be found on the MET website, and we'll put the link there. And wanted to thank also Edith Lando, as they will supply and create these different funds for individuals who submit as an honorarium for your work. One last thank you to our absolutely incredible guest and somebody who I'm very much looking forward to working with, Dr. Ardavan Ezra Adarad. And it's been such a great pleasure. And thank you to everyone listening. And I'll just leave it to you if you would like to say any last words.
No, thank you for having me, and thanks for tuning in. And I look forward to seeing all the knowledge that is produced from these discussions and how we move the work forward together. And for folks, don't hesitate to reach out. That's part of the journey. You're reaching out and initiating contact with people you think can be good colleagues, allies, co-researcher, friends, and whatnot. So, you know, build your community.
Thank you so much. And we'll leave all of that information for everybody on our site.